Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Casper Weinberger, here are the issues. What plan does the administration have to ease the critical unemployment situation? What can be done about the alarming rise in the cost of medical care? And will the poor, the sick, and the uneducated be hit hardest by the battle against inflation?
Casper Weinberger, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, the department with a budget of $111 billion, the largest of any federal agency, including the Department of Defense. Secretary Weinberger will be interviewed by ABC News correspondent Bill Zimmerman and ABC News commentator Edward P. Morgan.
But Secretary, you saw the President on Friday. Without trying to scoop him, can you give us a feel of what he is going to tell the joint session of Congress on Tuesday about the economic situation? Are we in for real sharp austerity?
Well, I don't, as you suggest, want to scoop him, and I know that a lot of different ideas are being discussed, and those are what that was the process we were going through on Friday. Incidentally, it's a very interesting process and an interesting contrast, because the President himself participates and will sit with the groups working over ideas and give his own ideas, and generally is very much a part of the entire development of the staff work that normally precedes the actual writing of the talk itself. I think that, first of all, the President is going to want to have as much help as he can get from everyone in the country. The voluntary citizens' participation that he spoke of at the summit conference is something that he feels very, very deeply about. I think that there will undoubtedly have to be some difficult measures taken to control inflation, and I don't think the President will hesitate at all to ask for them.
Would he ask for more harsh measures if this were not an election year?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that that is going to have any bearing on the message at all. The President is very much aware of the fact that inflation is not only our number one problem, but the world's, and that so many of the economies of the world are interdependent, that we don't really, I think, to put it frankly, have time to worry about whether it's an even-numbered year or an odd-numbered year. We have a serious problem, and we have to do something about it right away, and that, so far as I know, would be very definitely the tone.
What kind of difficult choices do you expect him to make in the area of HEW, health, education, and welfare?
Well, I think we undoubtedly will have to face the fact that government spending not only does fuel inflation on occasion, but that it's perceived as helping inflation. And in this business, what is perceived as causing inflation, I think, is very nearly as important as what actually does, because to a very considerable extent, inflation can be a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. People expect it to come, and they gear their actions accordingly, and therefore we get inflation. In our department, I think we will be asked, as all departments will, to review what we are doing and see what can be reduced or eliminated. But I think the President is keenly aware of the fact that inflation does hurt the poor and the ill and the aged, the handicapped, more than any other group. Those are the groups we exist largely to serve. And our reductions, our contribution to the anti-inflation effort would be geared accordingly.
You would try not to cut programs aimed at helping the poor.
I would try not to cut programs that help the poor. A great many programs that aim to help the poor don't, I think, at all. And the same is true with the ill and with the handicapped and the aged. And our job, as I see it, is to make sure that what we are doing helps those groups most because they need the most help, but that we do not use or waste government funds that might well be freed for more effective programs. So our effort will be to try to evaluate what we're doing and make cuts in those areas, or recommend them, because it will all have to be done by the Congress, in areas that will give us some more money to help the people who need it most without causing an increase in total spending.
Secretary Weinberger, the Scripps Howard newspapers reported yesterday that you've been having something of a hassle inside HEW on just the subject we've been talking about, namely that many people in HEW at the mini-summit a week or so ago went along with the recommendation that there should be no cuts in areas of particularly health, and that you had, this is what they said, that you had told the President that you would not oppose such cuts, and that there was such furor in the department that it might, quote, hasten your jump or being pushed out of your cabinet post?
Well, the latter is a totally unimportant consideration, but the important thing is that there are indeed areas of health and education and welfare that we are now spending money in that we could well stop and at the same time free those funds for a better purpose. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In health, we are still funding, and we have ever since World War II ended, a program called Hill-Burton, which is the program which subsidizes through federal funds the construction of more hospitals. We will spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 to $300 million in that program. We could well stop it. We have 60,000 surplus empty hospital beds. And running a hospital with empty beds costs more than running a hospital with full beds.
So, will you stop it?
No, we can't because the Congress won't let us. We would like to. And that is a recommendation that I have made to the President. It's a recommendation that I think many would agree with. The program could be diverted to far better usage. We could. There are some areas of the country where there aren't enough health facilities. We need more ambulatory facilities. But we don't need more bedded hospital capacity in a country where we have an occupancy rate of just about 70%. And that's an area where you could cut a program that's labeled a health program, which does not help the ill, but which in fact pushes up the cost of health care because it fosters the completion of more and more empty beds.
Well, how can it be that we have so many surplus hospital beds, but they cost so much more than they used to?
Because it does cost more to run a hospital with empty beds. If you have a hospital where all the beds are filled, the total operating cost of that hospital can be spread over more patients, and therefore each one can be charged less. It's a simple economics. But referring just back a moment to your question, the only people that I am aware of within HEW who would be disturbed by a recommendation of this kind would be some people who were actively concerned with the administration of one of those programs that we felt we could terminate. Another one would be the Impact Aid Education. This is a program that
been hassled about that before, haven't
yes, you? Always. That's an old one, and that's a program which allocates federal aid to education not on the basis of need, but on the basis of whether the parents of the pupils work for the federal government. And the result of that program is that the three counties surrounding Washington, D.C., which are very wealthy counties, get most federal aid from this program. And that's what I mean by trying to look at programs and allocate the funds where they will do the most good to the people who need the most, and not being afraid to stop what we're doing now just because we're doing it.
Well, now, I believe it was in last May when you testified on the Hill about your budget, which you wanted raised to $111 billion, which was a 15% increase, I believe. I got the distinct impression that you were defending that budget. Now you're telling us that
we in that budget we asked for reductions and terminations of many programs. None of those were granted. The year before we asked for reductions, I think in close to 100 programs, and the Congress only agreed with one. That was they agreed to transfer the Arctic Health Research Service to the University of Alaska. But the increase of the budget was made necessary by the required continual uncontrollable programs. For example, Social Security benefits increased by some 20%. Obviously, we will defend a request to increase the budget for that amount because we want to comply with the law. The new Supplemental Security Income Program was adopted by the Congress. That's about somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $5 billion. We had to ask for that, and of course we did. So these were requests to make necessary uncontrollable increases. To try to balance those and keep the budget from going even higher, we requested terminations of many programs.
If you could cut your own budget unilaterally without intervention from Congress, give us just a horseback guess of how much you could cut and what would be the services that would be eliminated or cut down.
I think we could probably reduce programs that we think are not serving the public and certainly aren't serving the poor and the handicapped and the needy in the way that they should by somewhere in the range of maybe $3 to $4 billion, but not very much more than that. But that would be a very significant reduction. And as I say, some of them would be the hospital construction subsidy, which we think is not necessary. Some would be the impact aid. We don't think it's a desirable way to go just to fund various institutions, such as medical schools. We think it's better to fund medical students who are needy and let them pick their own medical school to go to. When you put large subsidies into the operating costs of all medical schools, you're spending quite a lot of money to help students who are not in any way in need. So these are the things. We try to pick out where the people who are who need the money most and allocate it that way.
The Pentagon is now pleased with the heavy breathing on its back for economy, pleased to point to you as the big spender of the government now. My question is this. With $111 billion budget requested and 130-some-odd thousand full-time employees plus 100-and-some-odd part-time employees, how can you possibly tell, you as Secretary, Mr. Weinberger, that all of this money and all of these people are being utilized to the best interest of the taxpayer?
Well, I think I should come right out and say that nobody can, and certainly I am not one who claims to be able to do that. But we do see certain areas where savings could be made, where dollars could be freed for more effective programs. A very large part of our department is Social Security. About 60,000 of those employees that you mentioned, and you gave the correct numbers, incidentally, they are in Social Security. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $65 billion of our budget is Social Security. We aren't talking about any cuts in that, because those are programs that people themselves have contributed to and have earned as a matter of right. So those are not the areas. But we do see a number of individual kinds of programs for which we've recommended major changes. And in almost every case, we have been unable to secure the consent of the Congress to make those major changes. There seems to be a great desire to keep everything going that is in place. And if we have an innovative and, as we believe, a constructive new program, we may be able to get that added on top, but we can't ever get it to replace one. And that, of course, is what we think should be done.
Mr. Secretary, in addition to the inflation problem, unemployment is now at its highest point in 2.5 years, 5.8%. What does the administration intend to do about that? And what can you tell us about the prospect of public service jobs?
Well, there are two or three things that are of immediate forefront of the planning, and one is, of course, as you said, public service employment. Basically, and on a longer range, the thing that can be most helpful is to try to create a climate in which inflation would not be as dangerous as it is now, and in which confidence would be restored, in which case more and more businesses would feel like investing in long-range job-producing activities. At the moment, one of the worst aspects of inflation, this kind of inflation, is that it's accompanied by a sort of withdrawal. People are waiting to see if things aren't going to improve with very high interest rates and all the rest. And that creates a kind of stagnation, which is obviously a very very worrisome and a very bad trend. But to try to take care of that immediately, public service employment is planned. When unemployment reaches certain levels, there would be automatically triggered federal funds that would go into states and local governments to encourage them to employ people who are already trained but have lost jobs because of the current economic conditions, and to try to have those jobs be as useful as possible, to have them be necessary employment. And of course, at all times, trying to encourage the return of conditions in which private sector jobs would be created, but to recognize that we need something to tide people over during this very difficult time.
Perhaps we can be more specific when we get back to this in a moment. Mr. Secretary, what level does unemployment have to reach before some of these public service jobs click into effect, and what kinds of jobs are you talking about?
Well, at the moment, of course, we do have a program of well over $1 billion, about $1.3 billion, that has an education and a training and a placement component along with it, and that is in effect in many states. We are talking about a number of differing kinds of proposals, some at 5.8, which is the present unemployment rate, some at 6%. I don't know which will be adopted by the Congress. But basically what would happen would be that on top of the existing program, this new program would be triggered by some such figure as that, and then additional funds would go to states and county governments, and in some cases other institutions, to try to encourage and to be designed to create employment for people who were displaced by this situation, people who, by definition, had jobs, people who had perhaps exhausted their unemployment insurance benefits, and so by definition had been working earlier, and try to get as useful work to be done as possible. And there's a lot of work that a lot of state and local governments have deferred that is necessary.
Secretary Weinberger, what's this we hear about volunteer jobs? Is this another one of the items that President Ford invited the public to write out on how we could all lick inflation?
Well, on that side, I think he's more interested in suggestions and participation and ideas and personal habits, so to speak. The idea of trying to conserve as much gasoline, the idea of trying to reduce the necessity for paying for high-priced services and goods at this point. There are an amazing number of things that families can do, and I think the president was on the air just yesterday with a number of suggestions that he'd already received, some from children that were extremely useful. I think he believes that if we can get as many people in the nation concerned about this, thinking about it, working on it, and living in a slightly different way to use less fuel and so on, we'll have a lot better result and a lot quicker attack on inflation. I think that's what he has in mind when he speaks of the volunteer effort.
Making a expansion of the global focus for a second, you headed the American delegation to the World Population Conference in Bucharest, and some critics, both particularly American, complained that the American position wasn't strong enough in terms of dramatizing the urgency of population control in the places that had it the birth rates, population growth rates, the highest. What is your answer to that?
Well, twofold, I should think. One is we did make as plain as we could, and in my opening speech to the conference, I pointed out the inescapable fact that the countries that have the very highest birth rates are also the countries that right now are importing a good part of their food supply, and that they face a disaster very quickly with that kind of a continuation of that trend. Secondly, I think many of those critics were people who feel very strongly about this issue and who felt that the Bucharest conference should result in a position in which the governments were all ordered to reduce their birth rates immediately. And obviously you can't get any kind of position of that sort when you've got 131 nations, comparatively few of which even recognize this as a problem until about maybe 2 years ago.
Was there any plus to Bucharest?
Oh, yes, indeed there was. There was a plus in the sense that 131 nations sat down and thought very seriously about it. There was an agreement to proceed in a sensible way, and obviously all will depend on whether the governments of those countries want to take advantage of it. But there was an agreement to make available materials and education, particularly about the seriousness of the situation, as well as family planning programs and others. And there was general agreement on the need to do something about it and to apply themselves very quickly to it. And I think you can contrast that with the law of the sea conference at Caracas, where they discussed things for 10 weeks and couldn't agree on a single paragraph and barely agreed on the ability to meet again.
Sir, I wonder how you feel about the Holt Amendment, which passed the House this week and would take away from your department the power to enforce school desegregation.
Well, actually, I think the Holt Amendment probably does more than its sponsors really intended it to do. First of all, let me say that I do feel very strongly that a desegregated education is necessary, and it's a very important part of the educational experience. I had the privilege of going to desegregated schools during my entire career, and I think it's a very valuable and important part of education. The Holt Amendment essentially would say that we, as a department, charged with the enforcement of Title VI and Title IX, which are the provisions that say you cannot, the statutory provisions, which say that there can be no federal funds to segregated schools or schools that are not attempting to desegregate. The Holt Amendment would, in effect, prevent the gathering of statistics to enable anyone to determine what the allocation of pupils by race and by color and so on was, and it would also prevent the assignment of teachers and pupils on any kind of a basis of color or race or the other factors that are in Title VI and sex in Title IX. Read literally, this would make it, I think, very difficult to enforce the provisions of Title VI and Title IX.
Let me interrupt you to ask a question as to whether you think it would have passed if the administration had lobbied more strongly than it did against it.
No, I don't think so. My experience has been that when the administration takes a position for something, it automatically loses. When the administration is against something, it usually passes. I don't think the administration's efforts, which were plainly directed to pointing out the problems involved in this kind of wording, and we did point that out, would have made very much difference. I think the problems have arisen from the fact that in many areas, court decisions and others have been much too interested in the mechanics and the numbers of this problem. And they have ordered busing in situations where either the local communities were not ready for it, north and south, or they have ordered it in a kind of mathematical, statistical way in which the whole idea was just to get a precisely equal reflection of the community as a whole in each classroom. And this then means that children spend a lot of time on buses instead of going to school. So there's been a lot of reason for the unhappiness with the administration of this through various court-ordered plans. But I do think that this particular amendment would make it very difficult to enforce what thus far has been the intent of Congress. If Congress decides to repeal Title VI, that would be something they should say rather than trying to do it by indirection. And this is going to be a very difficult administrative situation if it remains in the final bill.
One gets the impression that the South has done better in adhering to the law than the North on the desegregation.
I don't have any doubt about that whatever. I think the South has done very much better. I think the climate of opinion was prepared by people of goodwill who recognized the need for it. I think the North previously contented itself with criticizing the South. When the time came to do this in the North, the North didn't seem to be ready to accept it. We are using the same basic enforcement, North and South, all over the country, and I think we should. But our own approach has been that the blunderbuss approach of just hitting a school district or a community over the head by taking federal funds away is not the way to get the best kind of climate of opinion. And we believe that should be underlying all of our actions, both North and South, and that's what we're trying to do now, and that may represent a change from the early 60s.
Sir, let me quote to you from a speech you made a month ago when you said, since price controls were lifted, the cost of medical care has increased 50% faster than the economy as a whole, and this we must and will moderate. Are you talking about some kind of controls over medical costs?
Well, I have said with considerable reluctance, because I'm a free market man, I don't like controls, but I do think that there is not a free market in health care, and I do think that the increases have outstripped the cost of living, and the cost of living is obviously racing away at totally unacceptable levels now. And so I personally have felt for some time that cost controls are necessary in the health field, and as a matter of fact, they're contained in our bill of national health insurance. But meanwhile, before that bill was enacted, there have been very high rises in health care costs, particularly in hospital rooms. Some of these can be justified as passing on additional costs that hospitals are incurring. But the fact that they are going faster than the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is a matter of very grave worry to us, because it erodes the ability of anybody to receive health care. And for another thing, it's costing the government $1 billion extra in our own health programs.
Mr. Secretary, time is running out, but I do want to get this quick question in.
Yes.
With Mrs. Ford's operation, cancer is even more vividly on everybody's mind. My question is, isn't there a danger with the pressure for anti-inflation of cutting back cancer research and other medical research?
No, there's no danger of that, whatever. It will be increased in the next budget. Again, let me emphasize that the cuts we make will be cuts in programs that will not injure the poor or the ill or the homeless or the handicapped. The cuts we make will be ones in the programs I described, and cancer research is too vital a thing to sustain reductions of that kind.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for appearing with us on Issues and Answers.